Jaya Bhagavan. Jaya Bhagavan.
He's got the Good evening, and welcome to the Dancing with the Divine Masculine teleclass, in which all week long you guys have been sharing such honest, insightful, beautiful takes on the inner masculine, on our love for the inner masculine, and our issues with the inner masculine, the different ways we understand it, and the different ways in which, by doing this contemplation, we really do get the chance to come to terms with what the divine masculine is and can be. As I've contemplated the many faces of the sacred masculine, which I have to say giving this course has given me an opportunity to do in a way that I haven't done for several years because I've been so engrossed in the goddesses, in the divine feminine. But, of course, as Mahite said, the qualities of the divine are, in essence, the qualities of the divine, whether you call it the god or the goddess. There are certain aspects of the sacred, of the absolute, that are simply the qualities of the absolute. And among those are the qualities that we described last week as Bhaga, as the qualities of Bhagawan, the majesty, the beauty, the omnipotence, the omniscience. These are the ways in which we understand that which is absolute. And then there are the personal qualities of the divine. And in one way, the gift of meditating and contemplating the forms of the divine masculine and the divine feminine is how they help us see ourselves. Because truthfully, every one of us carries not necessarily the fullness of the divine feminine and the divine masculine, but we definitely carry facets, pieces, and we're definitely related to different facets and different pieces. And as I contemplate the different faces of the sacred masculine, there are two words that have been coming to mind this week. One of these is poise. Poise. I have a statue of Shiva, which shows him in a very unusual form. He's doing a handstand, and one of his hands is on the dwarf. You know, in the Nataraja, he's always dancing on a dwarf who represents the demon of forgetfulness, which is another story that we're going to look at next week. But he's one hand on the belly of the dwarf, who is turned on his back so that he's facing upward. And Shiva's legs are in the air. His face is completely serene. He's totally poised in this extraordinary pose. So Shiva is poised in his absolute transfixion in pure consciousness. Krishna, whom we're going to speak about today, is poised in his skillful action in the world. And in this poise, he's the ultimate controller, even though he may often choose to let go of control, while his Shakti, his feminine aspect, his power, is the divine energy that manifests everything as the world. And often in the poetry of the Indian tradition, the masculine divine, especially in the Kashmir Shaiva tradition, the masculine divine is described as the bearer, the holder, the master of Shakti. Not master in the sense of master-slave, but master in the sense of the one who contains the uncontainable wildness of divine power, of the divine feminine as Shakti. Earlier this week, Andrea wrote very insightfully that her divine masculine is the one who contains the wildness of her Shakti. And here, of course, it's very important to recognize that we're not talking about gender. I just have to keep saying that because it's so easy for us to default into thinking of masculine as male and feminine as female, but it's really not. And it's also important, and I just want to say this at the outset, because it's not something we're going to go into a lot right now, but it's an understanding that's really shifted the way I actually describe and explain the masculine and the feminine in their relationship. A couple of great, very brilliant contemporary Jungian psychologists, Gareth Hill and Polly Genley Haddon, separately, they've written separate books about how the masculine can be either dynamic or static, and the feminine can be either dynamic or static, and they're always in relationship to each other. So the dynamic masculine is the thrust, the creative quality in the masculine, and of course in men, the boundary-breaking explorer, the intellectual radical, the visionary, the testosterone-driven warrior, the aggressive, assertive quality of the masculine, whether it appears in men or in women. And this is symbolized by the phallus, the erect penis, which is, of course, also the oldest symbol of the masculine divine in India. The dynamic masculine is held and contained by the static feminine. So the static feminine, of course, is the traditional yin feminine, the great mother, the nurturer, the one who holds everything within herself, the goddess Bhuvaneshwari, for those of you who took the last class, the womb. And so the dynamic thrust of the masculine is held by the static nurturing quality of the feminine. But there's also the static masculine, who represents the lawgiver, the one who is the pillar of society, who's a nurturing father, the king, the ruler, the one who holds the world as Vishnu holds the world within himself. And in the male body, this is symbolized by the testicles, which actually hold they hold the sperm, and they balance. The static masculine is balanced by the dynamic feminine, who is, of course, Kali, Durga. She's the dancer. She's the young. She's the wild and crazy young woman who comes into the life of the static masculine and upsets it. And in the woman's body, the dynamic feminine is the thrusting energy inside the womb that births the child from out of the womb. So there's a lot to be said about the static dynamic masculine and the static dynamic feminine. But for today, we're going to look at how the static and the dynamic are manifested through Vishnu, whom we began speaking about this week and whom we've been meditating on this week. And we're going to speak specifically about Vishnu's avatars, mostly about Krishna, who really does embody the active, dynamic masculine in a very beautiful and complex way. So Vishnu on the waters, Vishnu asleep in the cosmic ocean, holding the world inside his vast divine body, is the static masculine. And as such, he is the holder of the world. He's the one who holds the whole world in his hands. So he's like the transcendent aspect of consciousness. And so often when we want to take refuge, when we have the need to really give ourselves into the hands of something greater, we actually can find this image of the sacred masculine as Vishnu, as the vast divine dreamer, to be an unbelievably nurturing quality of the masculine. So we're going to enter into our practice now, and we're going to do it a little bit differently than we normally do. We're going to meditate on the nurturing aspect, the holding aspect of the masculine, and then we're going to chant, and we'll come out of the chant, do our dedications, and continue. So you can Find yourself comfortable and upright. You can feel the seat beneath you supporting you, like the great serpent supports Vishnu on the waters. The great serpent, Asesha, Adyanta is another one of his names. He really does represent the holding quality of both the earth and the water. Feel that your spinal column arises upward through that central channel that we've been meditating on. Let your shoulders slip down the back and your chest lift and open. Begin to feel the breath flowing in and down towards the base of the spine and then flowing upward through the central channel, this time up to the heart. So the inhalation takes you down. The exhalation takes you up. And gradually, little by little, you begin to feel that the heart through which the exhalation is gently expanding. The heart which you may feel very soft and expansive, or you may feel as a little bit hard and a little bit tight because it's been a long day. So with the breath flowing in and down towards the base and out, up, expanding the heart, become aware of the presence behind you of what I like to call the divine backrest, the vast holding presence of divine energy behind you. Feel that you're being supported by this energy, this very large, very loving, very stable energy. And as you let your attention flow out the back of the heart, the breath is still coming in and going out, but your awareness is flowing out behind you, and you're finding yourself discovering that you are, in fact, surrounded, completely enclosed by a vast, loving, subtle cloud of energy, of presence. And you're going to name that energy Narayan. Narayan. Hearing as you do the softness of the R sounds and the vast wideness of the A sounds. Narayan. A is the sound of the divine masculine. Narayan contains the vowel sounds that invoke and embody the quality of holding masculine consciousness, the peaceful, containing, utterly stable, completely serene and protective, ultimate ground of being that is Narayan. The Divine One who holds the world and you. And just let yourself, as the breath flows in and down and out, expanding the heart, allow yourself to feel that you're relaxing backwards held in the body of Narayan, Vishnu. The one who rests upon the cosmic waters, dreaming our lives. And we're going to chant our Om Namah Shivaya invocation, this time as Om Namo Narayan. Same words, we'll just chant to Narayan, the form of the divine resting on the waters of the cosmic ocean. Om Namo Narayan Gurave Satchitananda Murtaye Nishprapanchaya Shantaya Niralambaya Tejase. Om Namo Narayan Gurave Satchitananda Murtaye Nishprapanchaya Shantaya Niralambaya Tejase. Om Namo Narayan Gurave Satchitananda Murtaye Nishprapanchaya Shantaya Niralambaya Tejase. And one more time. Om Namo Narayan Gurave Satchitananda Murtaye Nishprapanchaya Shantaya Niralambaya Tejase. Om. We ask that through the power of our practice, all beings may have happiness and the causes of happiness. We ask that all beings be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. We ask that all beings know the sacred joy that lies beyond suffering. We ask to be free of hatred, grasping, and dullness, to be poised in the equanimity that lies beyond them. And we ask to know the equality of all that lives. And with that wish, that prayer, again, attend to the breath. Be aware of the vastness of the divine backrest that stretches out behind you, that supports you. And see if you can recognize, even for just a moment, how your body, your thoughts, your emotions, your moods, my voice, the world around you, how all this emanates from that vast conscious blissfulness of Narayan, of Vishnu, within the body of the divine masculine, his Shakti, his brilliant, blissful Anandamaya, ceaselessly forms you and I and everything in this universe and the countless universes beyond it. Now, I know that as soon as we start talking about Vishnu, everyone goes to sleep. I know this because so many people shared it last week, that there's something about the vastness of Narayan, asleep on the ocean, coiled in the vast serpent Asesha, that just sends us into that sleep state. And so one of the stories about Vishnu, which I won't go into in detail, is how, after he'd been sleeping for countless eons, letting the world go on automatically within his body, some demons began to take over the earth. Somehow they had also manifested within Shiva's consciousness, as within Vishnu's consciousness, as demons will tend to do. So the gods got together and they pleaded with him to wake up and deal with the demon, but Vishnu was sleeping so soundly. So they finally went to the goddess. They petitioned the goddess to withdraw her Maya, her sleep, from Vishnu's body. And the goddess, laughing playfully, did so, and Vishnu woke up and dealt with the demon. And the world play in its active form once again began. So we're going to be talking today about the dynamic aspect of the masculine. And I want to say that we're actually going to speak about three different aspects of Vishnu. One is the principle of balance. The quality of the Vishnu Shakti is, one of its qualities is balance, harmony. He's the energy who keeps the world in balance. The second is vision, the quality of being a visionary. And you'll notice that these are the qualities: balance, vision, and the third is playfulness. The divine masculine is the playful actor on the world stage. So just as the world as we know it, the physical world, is less than it used to be, but still, to a large extent, The game on the world stage is to a large extent played by masculine actors, with feminine actors, of course, but it's still, to a large extent, the masculine actors who run it. But along with that quality of balance and that quality of being the actor on the world stage, there's also the beautiful masculine aspect of visioning. So the divine masculine is a visionary. Masculine consciousness, whether it's in a woman or in a man, is essentially visionary. It holds what we could call the memory of the future. Vision is really the memory of the future, because all futures, of course, are held in this present moment. And the visionary impulse, the visionary quality of the masculine, is to see, to envision the future as an already present reality. And Vishnu is actually the form of the masculine divine who's responsible for the divine plan. It's his vision that governs how the world will unroll. So when you call on the masculine energy of Vishnu, you're calling on balance, harmony, responsibility, nurturance of life forms, and the capacity for holding a vision and manifesting it into action. As we said last week, Vishnu's name means the pervader, the one who spreads himself over the earth. And as such, he's He is Dharma incarnate, that is, the visionary principle of balance and harmony. So Dharma, Vishnu's Dharma, is the subtle laws that keep everything moving the way that it needs to so that life can be sustained. But the thing that the Indian tradition really gets better, I think, than almost anybody, is the fact that this balance can only be maintained when the light and the dark forces are both acting together. In other words, the balance of the world always includes this subtle struggle between the light and the dark, whether it's going on inside us or whether it's going on inside the world. And of course, the light and the dark forces are symbolized in nature by the turn of the seasons, by night and day. But of course, they are also present in, let's say, more active forms, more psychologically difficult forms. And in the great mythologies of the divine masculine and the divine feminine, things are always going wrong in the world. So the forces of darkness, selfishness, greed, pride, force in the service of evil, are always struggling for supremacy, struggling to take over, whether it's inside us or inside the world. They're very strong and they're very insidious. So the dark masculine has the signature of cruelty and pride and arrogance. The dark feminine has the quality of languor, of seductive sleep, of comfort. So the dark masculine operates through lethal force. The dark feminine operates through seduction into comfort. And the great good news that all of Indian mythology and actually all the mythology of the world always gives us, at least except, I guess, in Norse mythology, is that the divine will always intervene at crucial moments to save the world from being overrun by dark forces. Sometimes, as in the story of Durga, it's the feminine who intervenes. Mostly, though, it's the masculine, and usually it's Vishnu. It's really as if Vishnu has pledged as the maintainer of the world that he will wake himself up out of his cosmic sleep whenever it's needed and come into the world, descend into the world as an avatar. And we're going to talk today about 10 avatars of Vishnu, although only one in detail. So in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna, who is Vishnu's most complete and alluring and complex avatar, tells his student Arjuna that whenever a dharma or unrighteousness threatens to take over the world, he incarnates in a mortal form filled with divine power to restore the balance. In the mythology of Vaishnavism, Buddha is considered to be one of his avatars who came into the world we might say, reform or reorient spiritual practice in the East. And one of the really interesting things about the way the avatars of Vishnu are depicted is that their coming literally replicates the process of evolution on Earth. So it seems that the sages understood biological evolution. As this world is growing up through the ages, you know, starting out as water and land with, you know, almost no differentiation, the avatars of Vishnu come in the form that's appropriate for that era. So the first avatar is a fish. The second is a tortoise, who's a land and sea animal. And the third, as the lands begin to rise from the sea in more and more permanent form, the third is a mighty boar, a great wild pig. The fourth is half animal and half human, the man with the head and arms of a mighty lion, very, very fearsome form of Vishnu, who literally tears a demon named Hiranyakashipu apart, literally tears him limb from limb. And in his next incarnation, Vishnu is a human being. He's a sage who brings crucial texts into the world, and he's a very warlike sage who carries a big axe and basically kills all the dark force warriors of the time. And then finally, he incarnates as the two most famous avatars, Rama and Krishna, who represent in very important ways the way the divine masculine can manifest in a human being. So one of the things that happens when Vishnu takes form in the world is that he gets caught up in the dream of the earthly form. He often forgets who he is. My actual favorite of these stories of Vishnu's incarnation is the story of how he became a woman called Mohini, which means the deluding one. Moha means delusion, and Mohini is the one who's she's the feminine form of delusion. He comes into the world to defeat two demon brothers who have conquered everybody, but who can only be beaten by each other. So Mohini comes and allures the two demons into having a fight to the death over who gets to marry her. And when these two demons are lying dead at her feet, she looks at herself in the river nearby, and she's astounded by her own beauty. And she decides that since she's so beautiful, she should have the world's most beautiful husband. So she goes to find Lord Shiva in Mount Kailas and presents himself to her. Herself to Shiva as a prospective wife, and Shiva looks at her like she's crazy and says, "You're not a woman, you're Vishnu." And Mohini goes, "Oh my God, how silly of me, I forgot," and turns back into her god form. So the avatars, and this happens with some of the others, have this tendency to forget who they are. In other words, even God forgets who they are, who he is. And in his form as Rama, the great warrior king, Vishnu represents the absolute incarnation of Dharma, of goodness, of the virtues of loyalty, warrior spirit. Rama is beautiful, he's a faithful husband, he never exhibits a trace of ambition or egotism, he's completely detached, he's been taught by great sages to look at the world with detachment. He has the virtues of classical patriarchy and classical patriarchal dharma in its best sense. So in fact, Rama is so good, he's so upright, he's so perfect, that to many people, myself included, he's always seemed a little bit too good to be true. When you see, you know, one of the great epics of India is the Ramayana, which is the story of how Rama is exiled to the forest with his wife Sita and his brother, and then when the demon Ravana steals Sita, Rama fights a great battle to win her back, and in the process gets together an army of monkeys led, including Hanuman, the great monkey god, who's considered in all of literature the greatest devotee and servant of God. But what I always experienced when I would see the Ramayana performed was that Ravana, the demon, was incredibly exciting and interesting, and that no actor could portray Rama in such a way that he just didn't seem dull. He's so pure and perfect that he doesn't have any good lines. But the interesting thing is, you know, it's simply true that in order to catch our attention, the divine has to exhibit some qualities of eccentricity. But the thing is that Rama, when you practice with the thought of Rama, when you meditate with his mantra or with his name, what you discover is that inside Rama's name, and even inside the stories, when you meditate on him, when you contemplate him, you realize that his name and form are the absolute incarnation of love. So there is good reason why Hanuman, the monkey god, opened his heart to find Ram and Sita in his heart. His love is heart-melting, subtle, and very deep. And one of the ways that Rama embodies the sacred masculine, one of the really important ways in which Rama embodies the sacred masculine is in being a king. He's the archetypal righteous king. And in the ancient traditions, of course, the king, the leader, is the mediator between the human world and the divine world. I used to feel when Obama was running for president in 2008 that there was about him a quality, that quality of the king, of being the king. And one of the reasons why I think we were all so attracted to him, and in fact I do believe that Obama holds that quality, is because a lot of us recognized the kingness of him, his righteousness as a leader. When I met my guru, I had that feeling of completion that was not, it was spiritual, but beyond it was this feeling that I'd met my king. My guru was like a king. He wasn't a classic holy man. He was a leader. He was a holy man also. But for the people who gathered around him as he traveled in the West, there was this tremendous desire to serve, like Hanuman's desire to serve Rama. And in a sense, serving him, serving the king, especially serving the king who carried a spiritual, who was not simply a worldly king, but a king who drew people to the spirit. It really did feel as though this was, in some sense, the purpose of our lives. So the divine masculine, at his best, in his form as the king, as the righteous king, has this capacity to become a beacon for all the people in his kingdom, all the people who gather around him, to give them a sense of purpose in their lives and to give them a sense of worthy service. And it's one of the most powerful and important qualities of the sacred masculine. We need the king. When we don't have the king, we are, in a certain sense, lost. We are forced to rely on our own individual... excuse me. We're forced to rely on ourselves in a way that's actually not how it should be. And it's one of the reasons that life is so confusing and why people will often cluster around a leader who carries the king quality but not the quality of the righteous king. So part of what happens, what Vishnu does when he comes to the world as Rama is to embody that quality of the king, the sacred king, who marries the land, Sita. His Shakti is actually born from the earth. And so we'll just take a moment and allow ourselves to tune in to the quality of the sacred king. Some of you may feel very comfortable imagining yourself as the sacred king, imagining the form of Rama as you. Some of you may feel more comfortable imagining the king sitting before you or standing before you. But let's, for now, allow ourselves to feel the inner presence of Rama, the divine king. His features are handsome, regular. His hair is long. He wears a crown. His skin is blue. He's made of light. His body is well muscled. And if you can let yourself feel the presence of this sacred kingly masculine energy within you, what you may notice is that in allowing yourself to identify with the king, that your chest may naturally lift, your body may become more upright, and you feel yourself filled with dignity, filled with deep sacred authority. Let yourself feel this. Filled with what we could call a kind of divine pride. Not the pride of the ego, but the pride of knowing that your body and your being are completely aligned with Dharma. So if anything is coming up that makes it hard for you to imagine yourself as the king, breathe it out, let it go. Feel the sacred silken strength of Rama as you, Rama inside your body. And as the breath flows in, you can let the breath flow in and down towards the heart and out, expanding the heart. Inhale with the thought, Om Ram, as though Om Ram is dropping into your heart. And exhale with the thought, Om Ram. Just letting that sound, which is the mantra that Gandhi used. Gandhi died with Ram on his lips. Om Ram. This is also the mantra of Hanuman. Without hubris, without arrogance, allowing the sound of Ram, Om Ram, to flow in and out with the breath, to center you in the heart. You imagine your head and shoulders in the form of this divine warrior king, the golden crown on his head, his long hair, in his ears are carved golden earrings. His nose, your nose, is straight and his lips are full. He has a garland of fragrant flowers around his neck. And he carries a bow strung on his back. His chest is smooth and muscular and his arms, your arms, are powerful. There's a yellow silk cloth around his waist, and his strongly muscled legs are firmly planted in the earth. Feel this form of Rama, the sacred king, the divine warrior king, as your form.
Thank you.
So just for a moment, allow Om Ram to continue to vibrate on your breath. We're practicing several mantras today. And what you're getting is a little taste of the felt sense of these mantras. Om Ram is one of the most famous and beloved mantras that there is. And perhaps you can feel in your body the stability of Rama, his utter absolute devotion to the good, his invincible power and his humility. In a certain way, Rama represents the absolute simplicity of the sacred masculine embodied in a human form. There is no conflict within him. He's totally single-minded. He has absolute confidence. And he's never done anything in his life which wasn't aligned with Dharma. So Rama came under the earth at a time when classical patriarchy in all of its beauty and all of its stability and solidity was very much coming into his own. And a full age later, eons later, as the world had begun to slip into darkness and anarchy, Vishnu is sitting in his celestial abode in a heaven called Vaikuntha, sitting next to his goddess Lakshmi, maybe they're at dinner. And when the bedraggled form of the goddess of the earth, whose name is Prithvi, she's a goddess like Gaia, she represents the entire earth plane. Her body is the body of the earth, which brings forth plants and nourishes beings. Prithvi, the earth goddess, bursts into Vishnu's dining hall, weeping. She says that the evil people in the earth are so overrunning her that she's literally groaning in despair, that she can no longer bear the burden of the wicked kings who have taken over the earth. And she begs Vishnu to help her. So Vishnu agrees to be born as the avatar Krishna with his brother Balarama. And he agrees to be born in the family of the worst demon of all, whose name is Kamsa. Now, the story of Krishna is very much, in certain ways, it's very much like the Christ story. There are similar kinds of avatars in certain respects. And part of the early story of Krishna is that he's born as the son of the sister of the demon Kamsa, who's the king of this region. And Kamsa has heard a prophecy, kind of like Herod, that one of his sister's sons will kill him. So the way he responds to it is by having all of his sister's children killed as soon as they're born. And so his mother's name is Devaki, 9 of Devaki's children have been killed. But when the time comes for Krishna and Balarama to be born, the goddess Maya comes into Devaki's womb and comes out as the child. And the guards of Kamsa seize her and kill her. And as they kill her, she rises up in the air and laughing at them and disappears. And in that moment of Maya, sort of deluding all the guards of Kamsa, Krishna and Balarama are born and they're spirited away to a cowherd village where they're given to the cowherd chief Nanda and his wife Yashoda to bring up. So here we are in the situation in which Kamsa, the demon Kamsa, and the herd of his demons they're kind of like Vladimir Putin and Silvio Berlusconi. They're, you know, they're real dark lords. They're very, very accomplished, very skillful, very clever. And Krishna, therefore, has to be thousands of times more clever. But in his childhood, and this is really how we want to approach Krishna, in his childhood and his youth, Krishna embodies the absolute playful beauty of the divine in a way that has nothing to do with dharma or necessity or anything except the sport of love. And in a sense, he's, as far as I can tell, he's the only form of the divine masculine or the divine feminine that so completely embodies unmotivated love as a path to the divine. Krishna, of course, will grow up and become a great warrior and king and statesman and teacher of Arjuna. But in his childhood, in his years in Vrindavan as a baby and as a teenager, there's nothing he's there to do but to open people's hearts. One of the teachings that Krishna gives Arjuna is that it's difficult to realize God in the unmanifest, because it's very hard to love the unmanifest. It's very hard even to envision the unmanifest. So when he comes into the world, he comes not only to restore dharma, but to actually capture the minds of everyone who sees him and everyone who knows him. And Krishna, the baby Krishna, is so radiant. He's so adorable that it's impossible to see him or feel his presence without falling hopelessly in love. Now, Krishna he's Vishnu. He's the omnipotent divine in this baby form. So he's always doing these crazed, you know, these amazing heroic feats. And Kamsa, in the meantime, has found out that Krishna's there in this little town of Vraja. And so he keeps sending demons to get rid of him. And the first one he sends is a demoness named Putana, who comes in the form of a beautiful woman and leans over the baby's crib. He's very, very young at the time, picks him up and gives him her breast to suckle. And the idea is that her breasts are filled with poison. So Krishna begins to suckle her breast, and the demoness becomes more and more ecstatic, more and more blissful. It's like just the touch of Krishna is totally transforming her consciousness. But as he sucks at her breast, Krishna sucks the life force out of her so that she falls down dead with a blissful smile on her face, and the story goes, is liberated from her demon form by the touch of Krishna. And there are, you know, all through his babyhood, his uncle keeps sending him assassins. And Krishna destroys every one of them in a completely casual, playful fashion. There's nothing of the warrior about him. It's just kind of happening. And all of them die in bliss. Because the idea is that any contact that brings you in, that brings you into Krishna's orbit is liberating. So as this life goes on, Krishna will liberate dozens and dozens of demons, often by killing them, but always in the act of killing them, liberating them from their demonness. And, you know, in a certain sense, it's, if we could consider the demons who appear in these stories as the forms of the negative ego qualities, what Krishna does is he demonstrates that if you turn any emotion, including the emotion of hatred or anger, towards him, towards the divine, that simply directing your attention at the divine will allow the negative qualities of your ego to be dissolved and ultimately to liberate you. In the tradition of devotional practice that Krishna represents, that the divine masculine Vishnu form represents, is that the only way you can escape the liberating touch of Krishna is to be indifferent. Whether you hate him or love him as a friend or as a son, as the women in town did, as a lover, as a playmate, all of these emotions, when directed at Krishna, will bring you to liberation, will purify you and awaken you. And it's you know, the path of bhakti, of devotional love, is historically the easy path, whether it's devotion to Krishna or devotion to Jesus or devotion to the Virgin Mary in the Christian tradition. Of course, the Christian tradition is a very devotional path. It's a path that's easy because in the path of bhakti, you simply allow the emotions that you normally feel towards friends and enemies to be directed towards this form of the divine. And the extraordinary thing is that it doesn't matter what the emotion is as long as it's directed towards God. The other thing that you see about Krishna as an avatar, and to me this has always been crucial, is that he's totally outside the rules. Krishna, while absolutely embodying Dharma, is also totally post-conventional. So as he's growing up, casually slaying demons, rescuing his companions when he gets into trouble, stealing butter from his mother, he's completely mischievous, anarchic, and absolutely without any care for the norms of society. And this is never seen so profoundly as it is relationships with the cowherd girls. You know, in the mythology of Krishna, especially the mythology of Krishna in India, his grown up life as a warrior and as a king and as the teacher of Arjuna is much less significant than his life as a child and teenager in the forest of Vrindavan with these cowherds, these simple cowherd people. Because Krishna was the incarnation of love, then loving Krishna was literally the highest and most ecstatic form of practice that anybody could perform. And because Krishna is love itself, the more you love him, the more you're freed from convention, from normality. So in the forest of Vrindavan, which is the sacred forest in which Krishna grows up as a child and a teenager, the trees, the vines, the river, the cows, and certainly the people are all in love with Krishna. And yet the ones who love him the most are the girls, the maidens. In the mythology of Krishna, there are supposedly 16,000 cowherd maidens. Probably it was more like six, but the mythology, of course, enlarges everything. But again, I'd like you to imagine the form of Krishna as the divine youth. This is a very famous form. Most of you have seen him, and if you haven't, there are some pictures of him on the website. My experience of the form of Krishna is that if you let yourself open to this form, that he really does begin to give you a sense of what it is that he really is in his essence. So Krishna's a child. He's 15 years old. He's a teenage boy. Like Rama, his skin is blue, but it's very dark blue. And his eyes are enormous. He has long, curly lashes. He's irresistibly beautiful. If you can imagine the most beautiful Indian boy that you've ever seen, because he's very much an Indian boy, but blue, with black curly hair and full red lips. He wears a peacock feather in his hair. And he stands in a posture. It's a characteristic posture. He's leaning. It's called the crooked posture. He's leaning on one leg. His other leg is propped up against that one. His hips are kind of swayed over to the side. He has a smile on his face, and he's playing the flute. The sound of his flute is the sound of love. There's a saying in India, without Krishna, there is no song. The sound of Krishna's flute is the most alluring sound in the world. Everyone who hears it is irresistibly drawn to Krishna. He is the ultimate divine lover. He's God as the erotic masculine, playful, boyish, seductive, heart-melting. And in one of the plays, one of the poems about Krishna, there is a verse which says, he tells the story, he's talking to Radha, who's his total beloved. Radha is the one of the cowherd girls who's closest to Krishna. And he says, I'm going to show the God of love that I can intoxicate him so completely that the one who intoxicates everybody, the God of love, is the God of desire who's famous for kind of driving people crazy. I'm going to intoxicate the God of love so intensely that he'll realize that he's just a drop of love and I'm the entire ocean. He'll see that while he churns hearts, I'm the one who can churn the heart of the churner of hearts. That his kind of love is never really satisfied until it satisfies itself in me. I'll show the God of love that though his brand of love brings only a fleeting happiness, my love gives a happiness that's eternal, that's endless, and that while his love is simply passionate, mine is a love beyond all qualifications. That while his love attacks, mine rescues. That while his love ultimately brings death, mine brings eternal life. By giving the God of love a glimpse of what a sea of love I am, I'll dazzle him. And transform all love into the exquisite love of the divine. And the women who join with him in his dance of love are all passionate creatures married to other men. There used to be a lot of theological speculation in the state of Bengal about whether Krishna's cowherd playmates were married or not, and everyone decided that they were married. So they were, in other words, in a culture like India, which is an incredibly conservative culture, the idea that married women would so forget themselves that they would allow themselves to join an erotic sport is the sign of how intoxicating God is in his Krishna form. So Krishna says, all of you, you know this story, I know. He says, All of you, listen for the sound of my flute. I'll be in the forest playing the flute at the full moon. And as soon as you hear the first notes, you must come immediately, whatever you're doing. So the poem says, at the first note of his flute, down came the lion gate of reverence for elders. Down came the door of Dharma. My guarded treasure of modesty is lost. I was thrust to the ground as if by a thunderbolt. Ah, yes, his dark body. How can I describe his relentless flute, which pulls virtuous women from their homes and drags them by their hair to Krishna, as thirst and hunger pull the deer to the snare? Chaste ladies forget their lords. Wise men forget their wisdom. Clinging vines shake loose from their trees, hearing that music. Then how shall a simple dairymaid withstand the call? So the sound of Krishna's flute, like the sight of Krishna's form, overturns all the laws of this world and its morals and social rules, because it comes from another world. It comes from that place beyond reason where rules have no place, where even the yoga of samadhi has no place, because nothing in this world or the next one can compare to the lusciousness of the play of Krishna. And, of course, as you know, over the centuries, the saints and poets who fell in love with Krishna, who fell in love with Krishna in his subtle form, because he was, of course, no longer in the world, were people like Mirabai, who was a queen in Rajasthan and who refused to give up her love for Krishna even when she was persecuted by her husband's family. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who was a great scholar who fell in love with Krishna and spent the rest of his life dancing and weeping and hugging people in the streets of Bengal. And in this tradition of Krishna bhakti, of love for Krishna as the divine lover, the highest form of devotion, the highest form of spiritual practice is the passionate love that the gopis had for Krishna. And in the tradition of worshipping the divine as the masculine divinity in the form of Krishna, it's said that the essential nature of the divine is bliss. And we've heard this before, but if you think about it, if you contemplate the way spirituality is generally seen in the Eastern traditions, and as we practice it in our classes, it's very much a yogic path, a path of in which we recognize emptiness, we recognize that the world is transient. We very often, especially in the West at this time, we tend to be drawn to meditating on pure awareness. And there's quite a lot of distrust of bliss. The last few generations of Western spiritual practitioners have, like many Buddhists, tended to look at bliss as a kind of transient and delusive form of practice that we're supposed to go beyond. But in the path of the divine masculine, in the path of Krishna, bliss is the essence of the divine. It's what's called his swarupa shakti. Swarupa means his own form of shakti. His essential self is bliss. And this is the very powerful truth, which I'd like you to see if you can really get. When you experience bliss, when you experience love in its pure form, which is the love that arises in your contacts with other people or that just arises spontaneously in the heart, in those moments when your love is without possessiveness or jealousy or grasping or any of those qualities that connect it to the egoic self, when your love is just pure blissfulness, then you are experiencing the intrinsic nature of the divine. You're experiencing the swarupa of Krishna. Bliss is God. Bliss is God. God is bliss. God is other things, but above all, God in his deepest nature, her deepest nature, is bliss. And in fact, this understanding of the divine masculine as the lover is really profoundly revolutionary. It's a recognition that overturns all of our concepts of how the world should be run. You know, Krishna is not majestic. He doesn't express the lordship of the divine masculine. He's not a king. He is in later life, but in this childhood form, he has no purpose. He's just there to play with those who love him. He's the divine as the playmate, as the lover, as the son, as the companion. He's the divine as your most intimate, inseparable, heart-melting lover. He's not aloof. He's not disengaged. He's totally present. He's absolute presence. And he's in the world for the sake of play. In other words, we could say he has no dog in the fight, even though he spends, you know, he's casually killing all these demons, and he's going to grow up and be really engaged as a statesman, as a warrior, as a king, as he's going to orchestrate a great war that will rid the world of all the evil kings, and he's going to teach Arjuna the Bhagavad Gita, which is the most sublime, really one of the most sublime spiritual texts in the world. He's going to do all that, but he's going to do it playfully. He's interacting with the world out of pure, loving, spontaneous freedom, really just for the sake of love. So when you think about divine freedom, one of the most beautiful ways to think about it is to just contemplate Krishna as the youthful dancer in the forest of the heart, playing his flute and drawing you away from your troubles, from your projects, from your fears, from your neurosis, from your desire for liberation, just drawing you into the pure sweetness of his presence. So we're going to do this practice of summoning the youthful Krishna, the being who, of all the forms of the divine, is the one who most purely incarnates motiveless divine love. And I want to say that as we begin, let go of any ideas that you should feel this or that. Let go even of the idea that you should feel love, because any shoulds are going to get in the way of his desire to be present with you. So you can refresh your posture. We're going to enter into this practice with a full recognition that the form of the divine that we're summoning is an archetypal form that exists in consciousness and can appear whether as a vision or as a pure feeling or simply as an energy or as a very subtle sense of presence. He has countless ways of appearing and being. And we're just going to allow him to decide how he's going to be with you, because he is going to be with you. In the story of the Ras Lila, his dance in the forest with the milkmaids, you see in all the pictures a circle of young women with their hair flying and their saris flying. In the middle of the circle is Krishna, this beautiful boy playing his flute, blue with a peacock feather in his hair, yellow silk robes around his waist. And you see that dancing in the circle with every one of the girls is another form of Krishna. So Krishna has appeared as the lover of every one of the milkmaids as they dance in a circle, as he stands alone in the middle of the circle playing his flute. He also appears uniquely to each gopi. So find yourself on a moonlit night, sitting in the forest grove of Vrindavan, with the soft river, the dark, moonlit river flowing past the grove. This grove of Vrindavan exists in a subtle plane. It's eternally present in the subtle planes of consciousness. And there in the very center of the grove, you see Krishna. You see his blue form, his dark curly hair, his large lustrous eyes. His mouth is full and red and smiling. His teeth are literally pearly white. He's a youth, an exquisitely beautiful young man, and his face is smiling. His lips are curved in a smile that's at once mischievous and adoring. And as you look at him, you feel yourself irresistibly drawn. How are you drawn to Krishna? Do you look into his eyes? Does he embrace you? Do you feel that his heart reaches out to yours? This subtle form of the dark blue Lord, the heart-melting, heart-ravishing form of Krishna. Maybe dancing, maybe standing in this spot, maybe sitting with you, may have evaporated into a subtle mist. But what you begin to realize is that as you sit or stand with him in the grove, his essence is flowing into you with your breath. As you inhale, you draw in the form of Krishna as a subtle blue mist. It flows into your heart and fills your body. He remains standing before you with his mischievous smile, his radiant dark blue form. And yet with every breath, His essence is flowing into you. Is flowing into your heart, is flowing through your body. There's no way you're supposed to feel, and there's nothing you need to do. You simply need to allow the playful divine lover, the Lord as erotic playmate, to breathe his love into your being, into your heart, for no reason except that this is your essence. Effortlessly, you allow Krishna to send his loving Shakti in through your heart with every inhalation and to flow through your body with every exhalation. Your thoughts are distracted. Just let them be as they are. Recognize that with every breath, whether you know it or not, whether you're aware of it or not, the infinite love of Krishna is being drawn into your body. It's flowing through your body. And as it does, as you breathe in Krishna's unique radiance, you allow it to steal your worries, to rob you of your fears. To completely fill you with his divine confidence that who you are is enough. Because who you are in every moment, despite how things may appear, who you are is love itself. And you may find that Krishna is changing form, taking the form of the divine lover who is more familiar to you. But know that the lovers who hold your heart hold your heart because of the love of Krishna. Even though the divine comes into the world, whenever we call for him or for her, even though the divine is present, whenever we ask that he be present, there's also a form in which the divine lover calls you. And right now, as you meditate in the presence of Krishna, consider yourself called by the divine lover. And let yourself feel how all the loves you've ever experienced are fulfilled as you allow yourself to breathe in the essence of Krishna's bliss and breathe it through your body. And relax into yourself with the awareness that he's always present, that he's always loving you. That however things may seem in any given moment, the divine lover is always there. Sit in meditation, let yourself breathe in the love of Krishna, breathe it through your body. Have a beautiful evening, a beautiful week. Let yourself accept the presence of the Divine Masculine as your lover, whether you're a woman or a man. He holds the love that melts our hearts. Namaste. With love. Good night.